For the last segment of our program, we take a step back as I challenge the faculty to critically evaluate where we are in cancer control, where we need to be, and how we can get there. In the United States alone, 55,000 people die of colorectal cancer annually, and I tried to provoke the faculty and challenge them for better answers. Dr. Wolf began the discussion by identifying what he sees as a key issue.
We don't have predictors of response. We have predictors of no response right now. And we're not quite there, even with the trastuzumab story, in terms of saying this is clearly going to be the way forward. I really think that we've got a ways to go. The other thing I think is going to happen is we're going to have, in a very spotty Brownian motion way, progress, meaning CML, there's going to be a holy smokes moment, or GIST, or perhaps you might say with R-CHOP, or some other things that start to move the ball, but it's not going to be in pancreatic cancer, for example. I don't think we're going to make this kind of progress in pancreatic cancer. Colon cancer, I think we're going to continue to make incremental improvements.
What's the death rate of colon cancer going to be in 15 years compared to now?
I think it's going to be, it's about 40% now, 35% now.
Here.
I think it'll be perhaps 25%, but I don't think it's going to be 10%.
So you think that half of the deaths in colon cancer are going to be eliminated in the next 15 years?
Yeah, but I want to emphasize that it's not going to be simply because of targeted therapy. I think it's going to be that people are going to exercise. I think it's going to be that people have better quality surgery. I think it's going to be better adjuvant therapy that helps, but it's not going to be one momentous thing.
Why not? How about a momentous thing, Dan?
I think there are some uncommon tumors where the introduction of newer agents recently might have a significant impact. And, you know, relatively non-toxic is a relative term. So, for example, sorafenib and hepatocellular carcinoma, given adjuvantly, you know, that population is out there. And we've had nothing for it, zero, until recently. But the data are pretty powerful. And it's the world's second, I think, most common tumor, if not the first. So there's one. The other is renal cell carcinoma. Who would have thought? You know, you have two or three drugs on the shelf for renal cell carcinoma.
Jordan?
The success, minimal though it may be, with sorafenib and hepatocellular cancer has a bigger play than just the three-month difference in median survival. It's revitalizing interest in the disease. Just as gemcitabine did in pancreas cancer, now at the same time, as long as we don't let ourselves get stuck like we did with pancreas cancer, where we made gemcitabine the only way we can do things, I think we can move forward in these diseases. I do think we're going to have a lot more success over the next decade, maybe than some of the other people think. But
Lee, you know, to my simplified mind, this is kind of like the antibiotic model. It always has been. Differential sensitivity, et cetera. Is that really going to be the answer? Or should we be open to something different?
Well, we need to keep an open mind. I mean, you've heard Bob talk about diseases and Dan talk about diseases, and every one of those diseases is driven by a dominant oncogene or a
Correct.
Single dominant force, VHL mutation or c-kit mutations, etc. When we talk about colon cancer, pancreatic cancer, even though we may have RAS mutated in 95% of pancreatic cancers, there are multiple other mutations that are ongoing. It's not a single mutation. And I don't think it's going to be as simple as genomics or proteomics, because we really haven't refined that yet. We do it a lot, but it really hasn't led to major advances. So I think we need to move forward on two different fronts. We need to look at the molecular genetics, not only of tumors from the right side or left side, but in the same patient who may have recurrent tumor, you may have a different molecular fingerprint, and you're not always going to be able to pull a drug off the shelf to match that fingerprint. So I think we're going to continue to make incremental advances. But as we've seen, the increments have decreased over time. It's not easy to be patient, but we have to recognize these incremental advances, try to determine the predictive markers which can separate out those patients. And in some ways, I disagree with the people who are saying we don't have predictors for response, we only have predictors for non-response. By having predictors for non-response, we are improving our ability to predict responders. And I think we really have to capitalize on these little windows of opportunity, such as RAS mutations and resistance to EGFR targeted therapy.
I mean, I guess my question is, are we open enough to other paradigms? Axel?
I think that's one of the key issues right now, because we're limited by how we approach oncology in some ways in terms of thinking in tumor entities. And we're not cross-fertilizing enough. We're not talking about, we are here among colon cancer specialists, GI oncologists, and we could benefit from input from breast, from lung, from kidney, from whatever.
Absolutely.
We need to get away from the idea, okay, we're focusing on one tumor type, we're trying to exploit our little knowledge about this one particular area of oncology. I think what we have to realize is cross-fertilization, taking input from other disease types like breast cancer. We commonly cite our clinical approach in breast cancer that we need to utilize drugs sequentially as in clinical practice. We also need the genomic approach toward cancer, the biomarker-driven, prognostic and predictive biomarker-driven research approach to breast cancer in our fields. And fields like pancreatic cancer, they can definitely benefit from cross-fertilization with more successful stories.
But if this were a war...
We could benefit from any fertilization.
Well, let's do some fertilizing today. I mean, if this were a war and 500,000 people a year were dying, and I was the general and I was saying, we got to cut this way, way back and tell me how to do it. Neil?
So I view therapeutic development as having three components. You've got the drug discovery component, which involves target discovery as well as therapeutic discovery. Then you have the clinical validation component where you show that a drug actually helps people in some setting. And then you have kind of these getting into the details and nuances and learning how best to use and tweaking that new therapy. And we've been successful in identifying some new drugs that have some modest level of activity, and we're now kind of in the tweaking phase. The question is, where do we go next? There isn't on the horizon an obvious next new discovery. And so while certainly discovery of targets and ways to perturb those targets is key, I agree with the other folks around the table who have suggested that we need to be looking at better selection of patients for the drugs that we currently have.
But I mean, is that going to work?
I think it is going to work. The challenge is with regard to the paradigms we use as clinical trialists. We have, as a nation, focused on very large studies to find very small benefits. And this has happened both at the level of the pharmaceutical industry, which has certain incentives to accomplish that, but also at the level of the cooperative groups and the public system to also have impact on patient care in that way. But it's possible that we're at a point in time where there's enough science that bears on selection and that will bear on treatment selection over the next 5 years that maybe we need to be thinking of ways to do smaller studies with a more ambitious goal to find better improvements in smaller studies and then use the results from those smaller studies to design the next big study, which hopefully will be able to accomplish more than just a couple of months of improved survival.
Norm?
I don't feel the despondency that I'm sensing from around the table. I think significant gains have been made. I think significant gains have been made particularly in the last 5 years. I think the incremental stepwise approach to prolonging disease-free survival, for example, is not mutually exclusive with a trial that gives you an epiphany. I mean, we've had examples of trastuzumab in adjuvant breast. I think we're going to see more of those. We're not going to see it tomorrow. I think to characterize this again, as Nixon did, in a cyclical phenomenon as a war on cancer, raises expectations, which I think are going to be unfulfilled. And I think we're making significant gains. Do we need a brave new model here? I think everything we heard today is appropriate. I think we should be doing smaller trials. But the 5% gain is still very important while we're waiting for the data from those smaller trials to demonstrate the new direction.
Joel?
So I think, as others have said, it's very unlikely that in the near future we're going to come up with many true breakthroughs in colon, rectum, pancreatic cancer and the like. And therefore, we are going to need to go in incremental gains, and they are going to be incremental because what everyone is talking about is being personalized and being directed at specific targets and specific abnormalities, which almost by definition is going to mean applying that to some smaller subset of patients. The challenge is how do we use the science that's coming on right now in order to accomplish those goals. And I mentioned this before when you're talking a little bit about prognostic markers. The same thing is true with predictive markers. In order to run the study to say that you really are targeting a 10% subset of colon cancers in an appropriate way, unless you really have a major effect on that, you start to need huge trials to test that out. And so I do think we need to think very carefully about how we do trial design to allow us to really determine whether we're hitting those very specific patient-directed endpoints.
Dan?
Well, using breast and colon as a model, I think that our biggest gains are not going to come from therapeutics, that is, things we put into patients, but into screening and diagnosis, earlier screening and diagnosis, number one, but also post-diagnosis stage for stage. Charlie, you've certainly published data on this. We're publishing in JCO next week, the next issue, I think, or this recent issue, I never read it when it comes out, is a study, fairly strong study from Southern California, showing that women independent of obesity who had more than 5 servings of fruits and vegetables and a minimal amount of activity had a hazard ratio for recurrence of 0.54, which was strongest in the ER-positive population. So I think the...
And that's not the first time this has been seen.
No, but I'm saying it's consistent.
It's been seen before, and Charlie's going to talk about
it. It might be as simple as for the colon cancer patient, for example, you know, earlier diagnosis, yes, therapies in those who have them, but picking the people who should or should not get chemotherapy, that is, being able to prognosticate. I think these are incremental things apart from therapeutics, of adding bevacizumab, of adding a new drug onto what we have. Diet and exercise from the CALGB trial. Totally, there is no negative study for this stuff when it's been looked at.
I want to know why we're not doing a prospective adjuvant trial looking at diet and exercise like now in breast and colon.
Should we randomize broccoli to exercise? Broccoli to chemotherapy?
Well, basically, it's 2 V8s a day and you've got your 6 servings.
Those, broccoli or chemotherapy?
Those trials are extraordinarily expensive.
Yes.
How much would it cost?
Well, I mean, depending on your N, obviously. There's nobody that has anything that's patentable or that will provide an indication at the end of the day. The current environment at the NCI is inhospitable to such trials.
How about charitable organizations, the public, have a telethon, whatever. Let's get a price
on
this thing and figure out what it's going to cost.
Well, yeah, but then we have to set up another mechanism to raise money for clinical trials that don't have a marketable product.
I would point out, and you were talking about breast cancer, you know, the prospective WIN study, and Charlie's going to talk about it later, the cost of that intervention, which lowered relapse rate 30%, which was 8 dietitian visits, was $1,000.
Right.
Bob?
The issue, though, in those kind of studies is compliance. I mean, you're going to randomize somebody to not exercise. Are they going to do that? Or if they do randomize to exercise, are they going to?
Well, you know, the one thing about those studies is that contamination bias, when you're talking about exercise, tends to be minimal. You know, if you look at the WIN study, the people who got randomized to control didn't do anything with their diet.
We want to talk about this when Charlie talks, but I'm on a more global perspective. But why aren't we doing more different things? Howard?
Well, when you ask the question about the trastuzumab model, I assume you're talking about the science behind the molecular biology and finding the right target and finding the right way to block the target.
Right.
So I think that I'm going to deviate from what everybody's been saying by telling you that I believe that is a severely limited way to develop drugs for clinical use. I will point to any number of instances where drugs were developed for one thing and they ended up being useful for something else because of the non-science. For example, Gleevec was synthesized as a PDGF inhibitor. Doesn't really work that way. The BCR-ABL story was a totally separate story, and the c-KIT was even more serendipitous. Cetuximab was being developed for head and neck cancer. It was because of a clinical observation by one practitioner that started the whole colon cancer thing for the use of cetuximab. So I think that if we tie ourselves to this model, 100%, we are really cutting off some very important aspects of empiricism that have given rise to other drugs in the past. And my personal feeling is that it's not the incremental gains. People spent major careers trying to make 5-FU work better over many decades by changing the schedule, by biochemical modulation. It didn't work. The thing that really changed the outcome with colon cancer were new effective drugs. So I don't think that putting all this, what we've got now, reshuffling the deck, throwing in some diet and some exercise is going to make any difference. I think when we have 5 new drugs that really work better for colon cancer, then we're going to start curing people.
You talked about empiricism. One of the things that we've asked every now and then in our patterns of care is, do you have any patients in your practice with extraordinary outcomes? you know, people who had metastatic disease and a tumor you never thought was going to get better, and they're alive 20 years later free of disease, and everybody has them.
Yeah.
Should we be looking at these people more to try to figure out what's happening? Yeah. Charlie?
That's exactly the point that I wanted to make, which is beyond the things that are mentioned, we have, in an era of finite resources, we got to use everything available to us. And what you mentioned is a prime example. I have somebody who I saw with metastatic disease in 1994. He got enrolled on a phase 2 study of IFL, and to this day, he's still in a CR. He's clearly a unique guy, and we need to collect the genomes, the tumors on all of these individuals and understand what's going on. At the same time, if Erbitux doesn't work as well in a tumor with a specific oncogene mutation, I don't think the answer is don't give those people Erbitux. The answer is what in that pathway should we target and give with Erbitux to make it more effective?
Maybe we ought to look at more than just their genome. Look at what their lifestyle is. What happened? Maybe there's something there we're missing. Rich?
So I had an interesting experience a couple weeks ago. I had dinner with Mike Richards, who's the guy that Tony Blair appointed to try and improve outcomes for cancer in Britain, where the outcomes are far below what they are in the rest of Europe and in the United States. And it happened to be the night that Tony Blair announced he was stepping down. Mike Richards is the first guy that has been this cancer czar in Britain. I said, well, what would you want to be remembered for 15 years from now? And he said, I'd like to be remembered for improving access to screening for cancer patients, mammography and colonoscopy. I'd like to be remembered for speeding up the time that a patient who's diagnosed with cancer can get their operation done. And I'd also like to be remembered for preventing the UK from spending a lot of money on drugs with very limited benefit like cetuximab, despite the fact that the licensing trial for that drug was done by somebody in my country. And so, you know, his perspective for using scarce resources in the UK is that he doesn't care if a drug delivers a 6% or 9% response rate compared to placebo and third-line chemotherapy of colorectal cancer. That's not on the table.
Is anything on the table to just try something different?
Well, I think we are in a circumstance where this year in particular at ASCO, we were busy refining things. You could say we were rearranging deck chairs, maybe not on the Titanic, but on a different cruise ship.
You know, I interviewed people, you know, in breast, lung, colon, thyroid, renal, lymphoma. And, you know, nobody was all that excited about ASCO, with a couple of minor exceptions.
Yeah, but ASCO's a flash one year and a bust the next. I mean, that's ASCO. And they're more busts than flashes.
What was
this was
year?
Not a flash.
Jordan?
I was just actually, first off, take issue with Howard's statement about the diet. I think diet and exercise are relatively cheap things we can do, and in fact actually made some fairly significant impacts if you believe the data. And, you know, you look at the data, the year that Meyerhardt originally presented the exercise data, there's also data on, you know, obesity as a predictor for just survival of the disease. We are ignoring the upfront to deal with at the end. And that's what Rich's point was, is that we're looking for these teeny tiny differences. And, you know, some of that is just, hey, all they need is a teeny tiny difference to get market share. I realize incremental benefit has a role. But our job is really to fix this disease. And I think we're allowing ourselves to slide too much to the incremental benefit. And we should be looking maybe a little bit more outside the standard boxes towards what can we do to finally separate out the patients, maybe take some gambles here and there for a change, because we are not taking gambles. Instead, we sit there in our little, safe, comfortable chairs, and we're not taking the gambles in the clinical trials that maybe we need to do because it's time.
And also, Rich, you grouped screening for breast and colon together. I see them as very different. I see colon as an incredible opportunity.
Right. Yeah.
Breast is, you know, not anywhere near as exciting. And I'm not sure I hear enough noise about that. Dan?
I had the privilege of working with David Kayat when he was president of the French National Cancer Institute. And unfortunately, he was much too American, if you will, for the French, and very entrepreneurial. And he does think outside the box, as they say, because he was looking at delivery of care, which is some of what we're talking about, is getting people to the right people. And, you know, that was just terrific to some of the less prominent French people. That's part A. Part B is next July. Don't be horrified, Charlie, but I'm going to go for my master's degree in epidemiology in Brian Strom's program and spend 4 years part-time going to school. And I'm going in public policy with David Ash over in the Wharton School. It's kind of a mixed program because I really think we can develop all we want, but if we can't deliver, then it makes no sense to be developing. And so this is...
Dan, is this the first announcement of your intention?
No, I've been talking to
the public forum.
Well, it's coming out.
I had to decide. I had to decide what am I going to do when I grow up.
Information I've heard.
Well, 4 years. The good or bad of it is that I won't be president of. I won't be.
You're going to become an epidemiologist.
I won't become. I won't be editor in chief of JCO. I need something to fill my 20 hours a day of doing that.